This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for July 1st, 2013. As usual, last week gave us a few interesting things to talk about. First, a speech by an IRS attorney explaining what's coming in the Repair Regulations Transition Guidance. Then, an internal legal memorandum in which the IRS ruled, contrary to the opinion of one of its field attorneys, that the use of sale proceeds to pay down a line of credit did not necessarily negate a like-kind exchange. Another defeat for the National Architectural Trust and the tax shelters that it was promoting in the nature of conservation easements. This is a conditional donation of conservation easement in cash, precludes charitable contribution deduction because of its conditions. The citation is Lawrence Grave. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about Notice 2004-41 and why Mr. Grave should have paid more attention to that. And then a fact sheet offering a streamlined option to free some groups from a backlog of tax-exempt applications. My, none of us should be surprised. There's lots of conversation about this on tax discussion groups around the country. This fact sheet really is directed toward those 501c4 tax-exempt applications that have been tied up longer than 120 days. Then the tax court slaps down an IRS attempt to create a constructive dividend out of a construction company owner's use of his own employees to help construct his home, even when he paid the cost and an overhead allocation. And finally, an affirmation in the Second Circuit of a tax court decision that should be obvious to everybody, but apparently was not to J&M Futon Covers Corporation. Interesting sidelight here is that it's been really difficult to find the original opinion. So we'll talk about that one. That one, by the way, related to whether or not a corporation could deduct the cost of vehicles and tolls that it provided to its officers and employees for the purpose of allowing them to get back and forth to work. And the court said that those are commuting expenses. Anyway, that's the lineup, so let's get started. On June 21st, Alexa Klayman, attorney advisor to the Treasury Office of Tax Legislative Counsel, addressing the AICPA Federal Real Estate Tax Conference in Washington, D.C., said that the coming final regulations on the capitalization of tangible assets, what we've been referring to as the repair regulations, are going to give taxpayers flexibility regarding when they adopt the new rules. While the rules will be effective for 2014, the transition guidance will allow for the final regs to be adopted as early as 2012 and as late as 2015, adding one more year to the transition. The government, of course, would like for us all to adopt the final regs sooner, but it's unreasonable to think that everyone will be able to get all the changes that need to be made made. In Notice 2012-73, of course, we remember, the IRS alerted us that the de minimis rule in the temporary regulations will be revised in the final regulations, and that change will be significant. Under the temporary regulations, it's a rule and not a safe harbor, which could have forced some taxpayers to expense items even if they would have preferred to capitalize them. So the government is reconsidering that position, and the de minimis rule is likely to become more of a choice in the final regulations. And then she confirms that Treasury and the IRS have been made aware of issues unique to small businesses, understanding that the financial statement requirement of the de minimis safe harbor can be especially challenging for small business taxpayers. She would not say how the final regs are going to define a small business taxpayer or what might be offered, but she did agree that a $10 million threshold might be the cutoff point for more liberal rules for small taxpayers to use a de minimis safe harbor. In any event, all of that was good news for those of us who primarily serve small owner-managed enterprises. Next, we have an internal legal memorandum. The taxpayer rents equipment to customers, implemented a like-kind exchange program under which a qualified intermediary acquires the relinquished property from the taxpayers, transfers that, acquires the replacement property, and transfers the replacement property to the taxpayer. In the process, the qualified intermediary is required to take a portion of the proceeds and pay down the taxpayer's line of credit. Then, when the qualified intermediary acquires new property, there is an advance on the line of credit. An IRS field attorney argued that the debt pay down agreement, which the taxpayer had requiring a debt to be paid down when property was disposed of, resulted in either actual or constructive receipt of the proceeds before the end of the exchange period, and so the deferral of income was not available. The IRS National Office, however, disagreed with the field attorney's interpretation and said that the facts in this case were like Example 5 of Regulation Section 1.1031K1J3. In that example, the IRS concludes the taxpayer actually or constructively received all or a portion of the proceeds from the sale of relinquished property. However, the boot received as debt relief was offset by debt assumed. And under that regulation, under Regulation 1.1031B1C, the boot netting rules, the gain required to be recognized would be the excess of the debt relieved over the debt incurred. The IRS concludes here that there is no distinction between the debt relief and debt assumption and the taxpayer's line of credit being paid down and then funds made available from the line of credit to acquire the replacement equipment. Lawrence Grave, G-R-A-E-V, 140 TC number 17, is the latest casualty among taxpayers who trusted the National Architectural Trust to manufacture charitable contribution deductions for their contribution of a historical preservation easement. Mr. Grave agreed to contribute a facade easement on his property in New York City to the National Architectural Trust, which is a qualified charitable organization, but which has been involved in a number of questionable conservation easement donations. Before the donation, Mr. Grave's accountants advised him at Notice 2004-41, had given notice of the IRS's increased scrutiny of deductions for conservation easement donations, and he sought assurances from the National Architectural Trust regarding his donation and his ability to claim deductions. The trust issued a letter in which it agreed to refund any disallowed cash contributions and remove the easement from the property title if the deduction was disallowed. Tax Court Judge David Gustafson, considering whether the promises made in the letter to Grave made the gift conditional, and whether the chance that the condition would occur was so remote as to be negligible, concluded that what is determinative under the Section 170 so-called remote regulations is the possibility, after considering all the facts and circumstances, that the National Architectural Trust reception and retention of the easement in cash would be defeated. And he concluded that there was a substantial risk of disallowance, based in part on the IRS's announcement in Notice 2004-41 of increased scrutiny, but also based in part on the fact that Grave knew and the National Architectural Trust knew that there was substantial risk the IRS would attack the conservation easement, and that was the reason for the exculpatory letter. The so-called remote rule is found in Code Section 170F3A and in Regulation 1.170A-1E. And the court, of course, concluded here that the possibility of the easement being denied, the deduction for the easement being denied, or the circumstances that would cause the easement to be revoked, were not remote at all, and therefore the deduction was not permitted. The National Architectural Trust scheme, of course, is to secure a cash contribution, an endowment, along with the contribution of the facade easement, and the endowment, of course, is cheaper than paying the tax. So you, part of the tax benefit of the easement is paid to the National Architectural Trust. Several of their arrangements have been batted down in the tax court and the U.S. District Courts. The bottom line here is if the organization to whom or to which the easement is contributed offers to rescind it in the event the IRS disallows it, that in itself is cause for loss of the charitable contribution deduction. Next, we have a fact sheet that explains the streamlined option to free some groups from the backlog of tax-exempt applications. Following a review of internal procedures To reduce the backlog of tax-exempt applications, the IRS is offering certain organizations that have applied for 501c4 status a faster optional method to gain exempt status. The IRS last week mailed 80 letters offering the expedited option to groups that have had their applications pending for more than 120 days and involve possible political campaign intervention or issue advocacy. The Safe Harbor option will provide those groups and others with an approved determination letter within 2 weeks if they certify that they devote 60% or more of both their spending and time on activities that promote social welfare as defined by Section 501c4, and they certify that political campaign intervention involves 40% or less of both their spending and their time. Now, those thresholds apply for past, current, and future years of operation. Solely for the purpose of determining eligibility for the expedited procedure, the organization has to count, among other things, any public communication identifying a candidate that occurred within 60 days prior to a general election or 30 days prior to a primary as political campaign intervention. Any public communication, regardless of any attempt to paint it as a social welfare intervention. So that's both good news, I suppose, and bad news, but in any event, we can now no longer claim the IRS for mindlessly holding up our applications. All we have to do is make our representations, claim the safe harbor, and go merrily on our way. Next, Martin Toombs. The individual here is liable for taxes on a distribution from his former wife's retirement accounts. We're talking about a $6,000 deficiency and a $1,200 accuracy-related penalty here. The court found the taxpayer liable for the deficiency, but not liable for the accuracy-related penalty because he had really bad advice from his divorce attorney and his return preparer. In July 2006, the family court entered a judgment for dissolution of marriage that included a memorialization that Mr. Toombs would acquire a 50% interest in the retirement account of Mrs. Toombs, incident to their divorce, and that he would immediately, upon receiving such funds, pay those over to her as partial payment of what he owed her for her share of the equity in the marital residence. In fact, the wording says, "Husband shall immediately cash in his share of wife's thrift savings plan and pay these entire funds to the wife." In October, the family court entered a retirement benefits court order, which would have been a qualified domestic relations order, awarding Mr. Toombs the 50% interest in the marital share, and he shortly thereafter withdrew $25,248 from the account, which was now his share, it having been awarded to him under a qualified domestic relations order, making him a participant in the plan. He withdrew the entire balance of his account and immediately turned that money over to his former wife. Now he goes to a commercial return preparer to prepare the tax return. He discusses the divorce, and he's received a Form 1099-R, distribution from pension annuities retirement plans, showing a gross distribution of $25,248. The preparer says, "Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll include the $25,248, but since you gave her the money, we'll claim an alimony deduction for the full amount." Well, there's no way it can be alimony. And Mr. Toombs rather wisely concedes immediately that it is not alimony, but he has an interesting alternative theory. And that theory is that the withdrawal of the funds from his wife's retirement plan and the payment to her constituted a transfer of property to a third party on behalf of his former spouse, which would have been covered by Regulation 1.1041-1TC, question and answer number 9. The court, however, said, "No, you didn't turn the money over to a third party for the benefit of your spouse." And they go on to say that you may not have foreseen the tax consequences of your withdrawal, but the Supreme Court has held that while you're free to organize your affairs as you choose, nevertheless, once you have done so, you must accept the tax consequences of your choice, whether contemplated or not. So Mr. Toombs is stuck with a really bad transaction because his divorce attorney didn't understand the federal income tax law. Now, the next question I have, if Mr. Toombs is not liable for the accuracy-related penalty, and the court said he is not, what about his preparer? The preparer, obviously, was not competent and did not give competent advice. And should the preparer now be considered for discipline under either Code Section 6694 or, perhaps, even by the Office of Professional Responsibility, which would be more severe. And something we all have to keep in mind these days as we prepare tax returns and give tax advice. Next, we have 140 TC number 19, Terry J. Welly. The court concluded that a couple did not receive a constructive dividend from the husband's construction company when all the company did was provide services for the construction of their new home. The taxpayers reimbursed all of the costs, including allocated overhead. There was no distribution of property from the current or accumulated earnings and profits. And this is one of those situations where you read it and you think, where did this come from? The IRS, they come up with this theory and they trap a taxpayer, and now the taxpayer is forced to incur significant additional costs and grief. The company here, the Judge Marvel, says the couple did not receive a constructive dividend. Code Section 316A specifically says that a dividend is a distribution of property a company makes to its shareholders. The IRS position that the foregone profit was a constructive dividend. Now, mind you, the taxpayers repaid all the costs, and they paid the construction company the allocated overhead. What they did not repay was the foregone profit. So the IRS is saying that the foregone profit is a constructive dividend, but there's no support for that anywhere, anytime, ever. The construction company was in the business of building multifamily housing projects, not single-family homes. So one could reasonably argue that there was no established value of home building in the company anyway. Mr. Welly's argument that a shareholder does not receive a constructive dividend when a corporation provides services to the shareholder at cost was sufficient to carry the day. The next thing that should happen, of course, is that Mr. Welly and his attorney should sue to recover all the fees and costs that they incurred in defending themselves against this ridiculous position by the Internal Revenue Service. Finally, we have J&M Futon Covers Corporation. This is a decision in the Second Circuit, very sparse. I can't find the original opinion, which was written by Judge Gustafson of the Tax Court. In any event, the issue, as nearly as I can figure from what's available, is that J&M Futon Corporation had claimed deductions for leases of automobiles and operating costs of automobiles, including tolls, that were nothing more than transportation for their officers and employees to get from home to work and back home again. The corporation is not permitted to claim a deduction for the commuting costs of its employees or its officers. They did not substantiate that the cost of the vehicles and tolls were an ordinary and necessary business expense and not personal commuting expenses, and they lost in the tax court, and their appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals also failed. Well, it's a wrap for this week. Thank you for joining me, and as usual, our advice, stay safe.